I'm your host, Jenny Worthington, and I will be introducing you to people and organizations around the world who are working for animal welfare. We're being called to participate in making the world a better place, and the people I will be talking with are on the front lines of critical work that we need to know about so that we can support them. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. Thanks for joining me today as I chat with Simon Jones, founder and CEO of Helping Rhinos, an international NGO based in the UK, which is dedicated to supporting animal conservation, most particularly saving rhinos. Simon tells me about the work of Helping Rhinos, which through its premier fundraising is able to support boots-on-the-ground project partnerships, mostly in Africa, dedicated to saving rhinos. He speaks about the daunting prevalence of poaching and consequent anti-poaching measures that are implemented, including patrol teams, specially trained dogs, and air surveillance. He also shares about baby rhino rescues, sanctuaries for rhino orphans, and work with the local communities to garner their support and add value to their lives. Please enjoy. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Jenny. Hi. Thanks for that that very nice introduction. So hello, everybody. As Jenny says, my name is Simon Jones, and I'm the founder and CEO of Helping Rhinos, based in the UK. We also have a branch in the US as well. And obviously our work, which is protecting rhinos in their natural habitat, and we're predominantly working in Africa, really, as that's where about 72% of the world's rhinos are. So with all of that said, you asked me to explain a little bit how I got into this world, and it perhaps was slightly different to others. So I actually, my background was in corporate. I actually worked for American Express for 24 years before deciding there were better things to do with life, but it was a bit of a gradual transition. So I was, I took some time, was working in conservation here in the UK for a while. And then in 2010, really, I spent 6 weeks on a conservation project in South Africa. And then in 2012, the same location where I spent those 6 weeks, a place called Kareka Game Reserve in the Eastern Cape of South Africa. So they had a particularly bad rhino poaching incident. And three rhinos were poached. One of them was dead in the morning. Two of them were still alive. Unfortunately, one of them only survived for about another 24 days before he succumbed to his injuries. But the female that was poached, who became known as Tandy, probably one of the most famous rhinos now in the world. So because of that poaching happened on the reserve, I'd spent 6 weeks and actually even managed to find pictures of Tandy when I was there, sort of 2 years previous, still with her big, impressive horn. It kind of was a bit of a, okay, now I need to do something. I was on a year's sabbatical at the time, working in a conservation project with big cats, actually here in the UK. And so it kind of all came together, that sort of business background, charitable experience, and a passion for rhinos particularly and wildlife conservation generally came all together. And although not necessarily even wanting to set up my own organization, I kind of felt it was important that education internationally formed a part of what we were trying to do, and that wasn't really happening anywhere else. So hence Helping Rhinos was born, and that was in March 2012. So since then, we've gone from strength to strength. As I mentioned at the beginning, we've obviously developed our headquarters here in the UK. We now have a registered branch in the US, and a small team there who are helping to raise funds for exactly the same causes that we do. We're looking through other areas in Europe as well, just to really maximize our opportunities to do what we do as an international NGO. And our main role really is raising funds to allow the guys on the ground to do what they do, protecting rhinos from a day-to-day basis. And that's the key, really. And so, we tried to set up, there's other rhino organizations out there. And, this problem is so big in terms of trying to protect our wildlife that that actually, you know, having everybody do the same thing is not a, you know, there's no sense in that, you know. Uh-huh. We're all here trying to do the same thing or achieve the same results, I should say. And so we try and set up slightly differently. So we try and take a real hands-on partnership approach with the people we work directly with in our projects on the ground. And we take the approach of, rather than everybody trying to do everything, let's have people play to their strengths. So, you know, as an international NGO, as I said, our strength is really fundraising and doing what we do. And that frees up time from the people who are based on the ground to do what they do, whether that's raising rider orphans, whether it's patrolling, you know, anti-poaching patrol units, or whether it's sort of flying planes in the sky to keep the rhinos safe. So those are, you know, and that way we form a much more effective, you know, team, and the sum of the parts being stronger than individuals. So I firmly believe that that's the right way for conservation to go. Is more of that team basis. So that's what we've been building over the last 8 to 9 years in terms of building the strengthening those partnerships. And I'm really pleased to say that you know, in that time, we've now spent over £1 million in terms of protecting rhinos. So, you know, it's just over $1.2 million. And that's sort of growing year on year. And, you know, despite the challenges that obviously the COVID-19 pandemic is presenting the whole world in every area, you know, we've had to make some changes, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but we've had to make some changes in the way we operate a little. And that obviously does have an impact when you're fundraising in such a time, but the rhinos still need us, and they need protecting, you know, as they've always done. So that's kind of how we got started, how we've got to where we are now. You know, there's a lot of, everybody I'm sure will have heard of the threats to rhinos from the poachers. And I mentioned Tandy earlier, you know, and that continues to be an ongoing threat. Although we are seeing, you know, a stabilization and even reduction in some of those numbers now, which is brilliant, because it obviously means the last decade of work we've been doing is starting to reap some rewards. That said, it's vitally important that we maintain that anti-poaching work. You know, we've been here before a few decades ago, and, you know, it came back to bite us because we didn't maintain that sort of important anti-poaching work, because we felt like, you know, okay, we don't seem to have a problem anymore. They're not being poached. Well, guess what? The poaching syndicates were working in the background to come back bigger and stronger. And we need to make sure that we're the ones staying ahead of the game. So that's vitally important. But of increasing importance is the protection of the habitat that rhinos need, the land, you know, maintaining strong biodiversity and healthy ecosystems. And, you know, we're hearing a lot of that, I think, certainly here in the UK. There's certainly David Attenborough programs on, it seems, every other day at the moment, and really hard-hitting programs around what's happening to our planet. And, you know, the importance of keeping you know, a vast biodiversity and different species there. You know, as a rhinos as a keystone species play a vital role in maintaining healthy environments for many other species, including us humans. You know, even rhinos in Africa have a massive impact on the overall, you know, atmosphere, the environment, and what that means for us as human beings. So we will have a, you know, an increasing focus on maintaining and expanding the range of wildlife, and looking at how we manage land for both wildlife and humans, that we can coexist and because the human population is growing, as we all know, and the, you know, the land mass is not getting any bigger. So we have to find a way that we, you know, we can all benefit from that land.
Yeah, I mean, those are really key things. So just in case there are people in the audience that are not familiar with the situation going on with the rhinos and why they're being poached, can you elaborate on that a little bit for people?
Yeah, sure. So rhinos have been poached for the record numbers for the last decade. You know, at one point we were losing, you know, over for 5 years, we lost 5 consecutive years, over 1,000 rhinos to poachers every single year. And they're being poached for the horn. You know, you can see behind me here these rhinos and their rather impressive horns. So they're being poached for their horn. And the rhino's horn is made of keratin, which is essentially the same substance that makes up humans' hair and fingernails. But in certain Asian countries, then there's a belief that the rhino horn can cure all sorts of ailments, from cancer right through to the common cold. And as a result of that, criminal syndicates were coming to play and putting a lot of money into, making sure that into the operations behind the poaching. And it kind of resulted in the end, ultimately, because it's still illegal to transport rhino horn. You know, it's a restricted substance. And on the black market, at one point, it was fetching more per kilogram than any other substance or commodity in the world. So, you could buy a kilogram of gold or platinum or heroin for less than you could go and buy a kilogram of rhino horn, which, when you think it's just compressed hair, is absolutely ludicrous to think that it got to that stage. We were talking between $65,000 and $100,000 per kilogram at one point. That has dropped a little bit, but in recent years, thankfully, but it's still, way, way too high when you think about what it is. And so what that meant, when you get something that's worth such high values on the black market, then the use for rhino horn became much greater even than the sort of traditional Asian medicines that it was had its origins in. And what you started to see, it was become a status symbol. So people, wealthy businessmen were buying rhino horn as a status symbol, just to show that they could. And the sort of analogy I would often use is, in the Western world, somebody, for example, might offer you or a business partner, a lift in their Ferrari somewhere. They don't really want to give you a lift in their Ferrari. They just want you to know that they've got one. And the same sort of thing with rhino horn as well. And we saw that, as that value starts to drop down, we start to see that sort of use as a status symbol reduce slightly. And that, I think, is having some sort of impact in what we've achieved in the last 3 or 4 years in terms of successful or successful reduction in the poaching numbers. But let's not kid ourselves. We're still losing 400 or 500 rhinos to poachers a year. So it's not like the problem's gone away. I mean, in 2017, which was kind of the year before this outbreak of poaching started, 2007, before this poaching crisis really took off, we lost 13 rhinos in South Africa to poaching. So, even that is way too many. But if we could lose 13 a year versus the 1,000 plus we were losing, and even now 400 or 500, then we still have a long way to go to get to those numbers. So, I think you'll hear certain organizations like us trying to give honest messaging in terms of where we're at. But yes, poaching might be coming down, and that's good because it means we're doing something right. But the problem hasn't gone away. We still have a lot of work to do to reduce it down even further.
Right. Well, and that it creates an issue also with the local populations who are working hard for small amounts of money, and then they have this opportunity put in their lap to in some way help the poaching in a way that way surpasses what they would make just doing a normal job. So that must be quite a challenge to deal with the local population just on that level.
Yeah, I think you need to we need to be clear. So obviously, we talk about the amount that rhino horn can get on the black market or can sell for on the black market, but that's not indicative of what the poacher on the ground will receive. There's different levels to poaching. So there's the guy that goes out poaching, typically somebody relatively poor from a local community, as you say. Then you get the sort of middleman who transports it, around from Africa into Asia, and ultimately you get up to the what we call the kingpins, so the syndicate owners, if you like, the people who are making lots of money out of it. And yes, we can arrest as many poachers as we want, but as somebody very influential in the Kruger anti-poaching world once said to me, you know, they'll, you know, for every poacher you take out of the arena, there'll be 10 more waiting to fill their shoes. And yes, there's high risks and they know the risks, but as you rightly say, there's a lot of reward potentially there for them as well. But I think it's also important we don't just say the local people, because there are good people, there are bad people. They know that it's the wrong thing to do. And I know of some very poor people who won't turn to poaching because they know it's the wrong thing to do. So I think like any crime, you know, there's people have a sense of right and wrong, and there's right. people that fall either side of the line. But when there is so much potential, as you say, you know, monetary gain for those poachers, you can understand perhaps why they might be tempted into that. I think, as you know, there's a lot of talk we talk about poaching. There's different levels of poaching, of course. There's bushmeat poaching, which is people going out to set snares, for example, for something like an impala or, you know, or the sort of gazelles. You know, and that tends to be more about either just trying to create some or to get some meat for the family. Or you do see that, you know, people trying to snare a number of different animals and set up a selling business within the local business. That's a problem, and that's a big problem for all animals, because snares are indiscriminate killing machines. And you know, it might be set for an impala, but if a rhino or elephant or lion or giraffe or anything else walks through it, they're going to suffer the same fate, because the snare will have the same impact. But I think, you know, and then you've got the poaching of things like rhino poaching and elephant poaching for their ivory, which is on a whole different level. And it's at that, it's those that people, you know, you will start to take risks for, because the financial gain is so huge. So, you know, when we look at all those levels of poaching, it's often said we need to make sure that the animal is worth more alive than it is dead to the local people. And that's a valid argument, but it's pretty much impossible to achieve when you look at the values associated with something like rhino poaching. So we need to be cleverer than just saying, how do we make a rhino, mm-hmm. you know, in pure monetary terms for an individual animal, worth more alive than it is dead, because we'll never achieve that.
Right.
So what we have to start looking at is wildlife conservation as a whole, which includes the rhinos. And how do we make wildlife conservation as a whole of great value to the local people, and how therefore that starts to build relationships and with the local people, and we start working together with them. You know, unfortunately, a consequence of wildlife, and particularly conservation in national parks, has been that, you know, people, it's been seen perhaps as the rich man's playground, and the poorer communities get nothing out of that. So we have to start to change that, and we have to start to manage our wildlife. And this is what I was starting to allude to earlier, in a way that everybody can benefit from that. In there are many different ways that can happen. So as an example, we work with Alpejeta Conservancy in Kenya, and they have fantastic relationships with the local communities. They rebuilt schools, but when they rebuild a school, it's kind of what I call Lincoln labeling. So it's very clear that school has been rebuilt because of Alpejeta Conservancy being there. The same things with local medical dispensaries. The same things with giving a business advice to local people, so they can set up businesses and generate a livelihood. So we're improving livelihoods of the local people and making it very clear that that's happening because the wildlife is there. And then that generates a trust with the local people, and they start to see the value of that being there. So now when we hear of potential poachers, operating, then someone within the community will call the appropriate people within the conservancy, and will let them know, you might want to be on guard at this area on this time on this night, and then we can apprehend the poachers. And it takes time to build that trust and build those relationships, but it works. And guess what? We've had no rhinos poached in the last 3 years on Alpejeta. And that's not to say that takes away from the importance of traditional anti-poaching and, you know, patrols on the ground and anti-poaching dog units and monitoring each rhino and making sure we get a visual check on them every single rhino every single week. But so there's many different parts to play at this. But the point, I suppose, is it's important to understand that the local people have a critical role to play going forward. And it's how we build those relationships, build those bridges, and kind of all work together.
I love that. I think that is really the key to sustaining the entire conservation issue. Involving the people that are there in that area. I mean, they're the ones that are living there, and it's their place. And, you know, they should be allowed to enjoy it and have a part in helping to protect it. So, and I think it's key to get the local community involved and educated and taken care of. So I think that's amazing. I would love to hear about how the poaching actually works. And without getting like too gory, I think it's important for people to know just how it's so devastating on so many levels to the rhinos that are being poached and then to their offspring. And I don't know that a lot of people are aware of how it happens, like what the process is from like the poachers finding the rhino to taking the rhino down and what they do and all that. Can you go into that a little bit so people have an idea of exactly what people on the ground are dealing with when they're trying to take care of these rhinos?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's not pleasant, and I won't make it too graphic for everybody watching, but yeah. So essentially, as we said, there's different levels to poaching, starting at the syndicates and the money men and the people who are getting rich on the back of it, you know, down to the poachers on the ground. And obviously they're the ones, you know, facing the biggest risks because they're the ones, you know, on the ground every day. They operate typically at night because it's easier to go undercover, obviously in darkness. On the whole still, you know, when you find poachers, we always talk about the full moon being a poacher's moon because the full moon gives a lot of natural light. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly no need for torches or anything like that. And then what happens is that the poachers will come and locate a rhino. I hate to say it, but unfortunately, a lot of time that comes from information that they've gained from the inside somewhere. And then once they locate the rhino, and this is where things have, you know, kind of evolved and changed over the last decade, you know, because what you used to see was, you know, a poacher would come out with a hunting rifle and, you know, potluck would shoot the animal and take the horn or you know, in the case of rhinos, tusks, if it was elephants, for example. You know, now it's become such a high-tech process. They have, you know, we even hear some poachers being given night vision goggles, for example, because they've been purchased. You know, you no longer get a sole poacher out on his own. You know, you'll have one poacher who's carrying the rucksack to put the horn in. You'll have a poacher carrying the rifle to shoot the animal with, and then you'll have another third guy who's carrying an AK-47 to shoot the anti-poaching patrol rangers who come after them. That's what happens now. So when they find a rhino, they'll shoot the rhino. I hate to say that, you know, quite often they don't kill the rhino outright. We've seen horrible instances of, you know, rhinos having their spines hacked with machetes or big axes, because what the poachers want to do is make as little noise as possible. So they don't want to keep firing. So they'll do as fewer shots as they can, as little noise as possible. And I hate to say it, they don't care about the pain that the animal is in. They just want to take the horn off. So all they do is as quickly as they can, will take the horn off, and they'll take every last centimeter that they can from the horn and the depth down into the face. And then they get out as quickly as they can. They'll often have a vehicle waiting at a certain point in the fence to drive them away as quickly as possible. And meanwhile, the animal, I hate to say, you know, if it wasn't lucky enough to die straight away, is going to bleed to death there unless it's found. So, excuse me. So that's kind of what happens, you know. Rangers, as soon as there's an alert, and we've put lots of new technology in to try and identify and try and preempt the poaching attack in the first place. I mean, that's the key. Well, you know, 10 years ago, there was a lot more focus, I guess, on how do we apprehend the poachers? How do we catch the poachers? You know, now what we want to do is try and stop the poaching, because if you only catch the poachers after they've poached, it's too late and the animal's already dead. So that's kind of what happens, you know. And then, as I said earlier, you know, you've got one of the poaching gangs will typically be carrying something like an AK-47 to defend themselves when they come under fire from the anti-poaching units. And what you see, you know, and that shows you what risk that those guys put in their lives. And, you know, we know that there's been over 1,000 rangers have been killed just trying to defend our wildlife.
Wow.
And when you think that a lot of these people, you know, now it's very militarized and people joining anti-poaching units come from a military background. But, you know, we go back at the start of this, that wasn't the case. These people were conservationists. They joined to protect animals, you know, and understand what we need to do from an ecology point of view. You know, that has changed, and we see a lot more military, you know, militarized anti-poaching, and that's what it needs to be, because, you know, it really, people talked about it being a war, and it kind of was a war, really, in terms of how we were dealing with that. So that's what happens. There are other examples as well, where rather than a rifle, a tranquilizer gun has been used. So applying like a dart, anesthetic dart, to knock the animal down. And for that to happen, again, you know, I mentioned there's people on the inside job, that means somewhere along the line, a vet has been bought into, and I say bought in every sense of the word, been bought into the operation. For them to get those drugs. And that's what happened. And I mentioned Tandy earlier, the rhino who was poached at Kareka in Eastern Cape of South Africa. So there was a gang who was using, you know, consistently using tranquilizer guns, because they're a lot quieter than a hunting rifle. So again, raises less noise. And then what happens is, because the animal is knocked out, and then once they start to wake up, you know, they were now waking up from the anesthetic, and their face has been hacked off. And, you know, that's if they've survived that pace of it. So, and that's what happened with the rhino who survived at the Tandy poaching, you know, Temba, he survived for 24 days. But actually, when you knock a rhino down, it's a big 2.5-ton bulky animal. And so if you're putting a rhino down for medical reasons, you would keep turning so they don't work that whole 2.5 tons on their legs, for example. Of course, the poachers don't care about it. So they're left. So what happens, you see lots of infections getting into legs and muscle damage. And that's effectively what happened to Temba, the bull who didn't survive. Was he didn't actually die of the facial wounds. He died in the end of the abscesses that were on his leg, and he actually ended up drowning in a water hole. But to try and bring everyone back on a bit of a, you know, there's a bit of hope at the end of it as well. You know, we talked about Tandy, and September didn't make it, and Tandy did. And then, you know, the great news was that Tandy went on to have a calf who was named Tembi. And she's since had two other calves. And if anybody's interested, you can actually go into to the Helping Rhinos website, go to our events page, and you'll see we did an online event earlier in the year where we took a film crew out to sort of stand shoulder to shoulder with the vets as they went to do a procedure on Tandy's second calf. So there's a lot of great information, great footage there. But the fantastic news to end this on is that actually to Tembi, so the first calf of Tandy, has just had a calf of her own. So, you know, Tandy is now a grandmother, and I tell that story because, you know, there was a lot of questions asked at the time, back in 2012, you know, because there was a lot of veterinary procedures that was needed to treat this huge open wound on her face that took 6-7 years to really heal.
Wow.
You know, and people question the amount of money that was spent on saving this one rhino, and is that money not better spent elsewhere? You know, and you kind of feel like we have an obligation. You know, she wasn't in such pain because of evolution or, you know, a natural event that occurred. She was in such a state because of actions by humans. And actually, as we prove now, it wasn't just saving one rhino. You know, she's had three three calves of our own. So that makes that four rhinos we were saving. Now Tembi has had a calf, so that's five rhinos. You know, the Colin, the second calf, is a bull. So he how many calves is he going to go and have? So, you know, so I think, you know, that's why we do what we do. That's why every rhino counts. And no matter what the circumstances, we will try and save every single rhino that we can.
Yeah, that's amazing. Amazing. I can't imagine how much work went into that.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, you know. And I have to say as well, you know, so Dr. William Folds, who's the vet down in Eastern Cape we work with, you know, it's and him, his team and the team at Kareka put, you know, emotionally, not just the amount of work of having to do that, but the emotional impact, you know, there's many people working in, you know, on the ground and dealing with this. Can you imagine having to, you know, that's just one incident I talked about. Imagine having to do that. And the majority of times you go to a rhino poaching incident, you'd be doing an autopsy, yeah, post-mortem, you know, it's a crime scene. The emotional stress of having to deal with that sometimes every single day. You know, we were losing three rhinos a day at one point.
Wow,
as an average. So some days was even more than that, you know. So you can't imagine the stress of having to see that over and over again.
Yeah, no. Well, part of your protection is are these rangers, and then you're also using highly trained dogs. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we exactly, I mean, there's so many different facets to anti-poaching now. So yes, we've got rangers on the ground. We work particularly with the Black Mambas anti-poaching unit, and I'll come and talk about those inspirational women from the local community in a moment. But yeah, dogs as well is, I suppose, a relatively recent introduction over the last few years, but proved to be phenomenally successful. If you imagine, there is many different roles that dogs have. We have bloodhounds, which are sort of your tracking dogs. We have even things like Springer Spaniels, who are your detection dogs. So they're sniffing out where, you know, weapons may have been hidden in the bush. Wow. And then you have your attack dogs, who are, you know, there to chase and bring down the poachers and the criminals. So there are many different types of dogs that play different roles. Some dogs have, you know, multiple roles. So, you know, they're trained and can do different roles within the team. But we found that's hugely successful, A, as a deterrent in the first place. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm aware, no anti-poaching dog has ever been shot and killed. Because if you imagine a dog is running at great speed and it's running, you know, at an, you know, often not just in a dead straight line, and the poacher knows what's coming if that dog clumps onto his arm. I've actually had one of the anti-poaching dogs with the protection sleeve come and, you know, bite your arm as a demonstration. So the power that they have is incredible. So you know, the poachers are more interested in getting away than they are thinking about how they're going to shoot the dog. So we've not had any dogs. So it's that they are a great deterrent, and they are, you know, a great at and actually, you know, apprehending the poachers as well. Wow. We had an incident last week where unfortunately the rhino was poached, but we did manage to catch the poacher with the horn in a bag, and again the dogs played an important role. So they do play a vitally important role, as do things like, you know, drones and air patrols. That's proven as well. Mm-hmm. Technology, even within fences, it sets off alerts as and when fences are broken. And of course, boots on the ground, you know, people, right. And I mentioned before, you know, the intelligence gathering. We've proved as well, you know, there's nothing like intelligence gathering, really. All of these other tools help us to reduce the number of poaching, but it's that relationship in the intelligence gathering with the local people that will allow us to continue to drop poaching rates at a significant level.
And tell us about the Black Mambas.
So the Black Mambas are South Africa's first all-female anti-poaching unit. It was a brainchild of the leader of the Black Mambas, a guy called Craig Spencer, who we work very closely with. And really it was like looking and saying, we've tried so many different things and nothing has completely worked. And actually, you know, what we have is, you know, the women in the local communities are perhaps one of the most underused resources on the continent of Africa. Mm-hmm. So how do we take these women, how do we give them a pride in what they're doing, instill a passion for the wildlife? And that's basically what we did. So we took 36 women from the local communities. They were trained up, both at a fitness level to go on patrol, but also from a military perspective as well. They also, of course, you know, although they're a huge threat from potential poachers, arguably they're a greater threat because they're patrolling on foot in a big five game reserve. So, you know, there could be lions, leopards, elephants, rhinos, buffaloes, anything, you know, anything that can do you a lot of harm could be hiding around the corner. So they have to learn, like all other wildlife rangers, how to work, walk, live within an environment with that type of wildlife there. So it's quite an intensive training program that they go through. And then what they do is they then patrol. So these women are all unarmed. And you know, we get questions on that quite a lot. You know, how can you put women on the front line who are unarmed? You know, it's like giving to someone, you know, a suicide mission. But actually, it's proved to be very successful. The reason that they're unarmed is, and there's a bit of a misconception that the Black Mambas are an anti-poaching unit, and they're not. They're a cog in a wheel of an overall anti-poaching operation. Mm-hmm. So their job is to walk up and down a fence. So within South Africa, the game reserves have fences to keep the wildlife from roaming into the local communities. So their job is to patrol those fences, and they do that every morning. So they walk about 20 kilometers every single day on foot, looking for signs of insertion within the fence, or cuts in the fence, holes being dug under the fence. And then if they see signs of insertions, then what they do is they then radio that in, and then the armed units come out, and if they need to, you know, they'll get involved in tracking. If they think there's poachers still on site, then they'll get involved in tracking that, but that gets led at that point by the armed unit. So they're very much that first response. They're a visual presence. Mm-hmm. They're a deterrent to the local people. And they, you know, 50% of their job is kind of back in the community. So they're building relationships in the community again. So they're talking to the community about what they're to do. We're trying to create role models. So, you know, unfortunately, for a long time, poachers have been role models in the local community, because if you want a big flash house and drive a BMW around, you need to go poaching, because that's how you're going to get the money. So, you know, we've successfully managed to change some of that and create this sort of role model environment of the Black Mambas. You know, some of them are, you know, traveling around the world giving talks and such like. So they're seen, they're very inspirational people within the local community. And they've even now set up an education outreach program that we call the Bush Babies. So we go out to local schools, and we have the most incredible member of the Mambas team dedicated to the Bush Babies who leads that, called Luane. She is so full of life and energy, and she's fantastic. And she goes into 11 different primary schools and teaches conservation. We do up the classrooms, the specific classrooms we take. We do that up. You know, we paint the walls. We put fans on the wall that can get to like 52 degrees centigrade in those classrooms. And it's not a great teaching environment. It's not a great learning environment. So we upgrade the classrooms. The kids want to come and learn. Mm-hmm. The teachers want to go in and teach in the environment afterwards. And again, it's all about that positive mental link between wildlife conservation, protection of wildlife, and improving livelihoods in the local community, as well as educating the next generation of the importance of wildlife and you know, the importance of and seeing wildlife, because, you know, people don't realize that, you know, many, many people in Africa have not, in local communities particularly, have not seen some of these iconic wildlife.
Yeah, because, it's incredible.
As I mentioned, you know, the wildlife reserves have been seen as, you know, exclusively for the rich guys. So, you know, we take the highest performing Bush Baby members, or members, kids from the Bush Babies program, into a camp, into the reserve every year, where we show them the wildlife, and we show them the biodiversity, and we show them the environment, the ecology and such likes. But we also start teaching them in their communities as well. You know, we have to teach them how to look after dogs and cattle properly, how to look after water. You know, if you don't if we don't teach that level in the communities, we have no hope of saying, if you just say to them, you know, don't come and poach rhinos and elephants, you're never going to win that battle. You have to teach them around, you know, the importance at their homes of looking after the environment and water and such like.
Yeah, I love that. That is so incredible.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a great program, and it's we're looking to, you know, how do we roll that model out and continue you know, using women from local communities and how do we replicate what works, and that's key.
Right. Yeah, and that sounds like an incredible model to use. So you had mentioned that rhinos are really important to the ecosystem that they're in. In what way?
So as a mega herbivore, you know, they what you find is they'll graze. So you've got black. So what have I got over my shoulder? So there's a white rhino here, which is what we call a grazer. So they have big wide mouths that will graze, the, you know, take up lots of grass and keep the plains open. And then the black rhino, which is on this side, is more of a, which we're getting there, a hooked lip, you can see. So they kind of browse and pull the leaves off the trees. Okay. So just by doing that, they're creating an environment and controlling an environment that says, you know, we're keeping open plains and such like. And then put very bluntly, they'll eat what they like over here, and then they'll walk over there, and then they'll poo it out, and the seeds will come out, and it'll regenerate there. So they're creating this sort of natural wild environment that you see when you get different types of species. You know, and then you get things like the dung beetles that are thriving because of the amount of dung that the rhinos. You know, if you get no elephants and no rhinos dropping dung everywhere, then your dung beetle population starts to go down. We have things like oxpeckers, for example, who sit the little birds that sit on the back of the rhinos and pick off all the ticks and such likes. You know, they play an important part. So all of this creates a healthy, natural living world that we all need to be able to thrive on and to be able to survive. And if you take out elements, and as we're seeing, you know, in many places around the world, if you start to take out different species, whether that's plant or animal, that has an impact on how the world and the environment operates, you know, and we all need the natural world to be healthy if we as a human race is to have a future on this planet. You know, we see that we're chopping down rainforests at huge rates. You know, that has an impact in you know, on the overall climate change, the planet heating up. And again, you know, you've seen it in many different, you know, different keystone species. If you take them out, it's not just a case of, oh dear, rhinos have gone, no one's going to come and pay to see rhinos. Although, you know, with your iconic big five and you know, iconic animals, then that has an impact as well in terms of, you know, income for certain countries through ecotourism. But the biggest impact is undoubtedly, as I say, on the environment that they have. And that's what we have to try and maintain. And we have to try and not just maintain, we have to expand that. So a lot of our work as we go, you know, move forward is going to be looking at range expansion. So how do we take land that's become degraded over years and bring that back to a level that it becomes a living, natural wildlife land again, you know, and then what do we need to do to start to reintroduce some of those mega herbivores like rhinos into that land, and understanding the whole bigger picture that is around the whole sort of wildlife economy, if you like. So how does, you know, I mentioned before about fences and national parks. So how do we move away from that model in certain areas and ensure that by reinvigorating land, restoring land, bringing wildlife back to it, and the local people benefit from that at the same time. As I said, the population is growing. And, you know, one thing, you know, if you the model that we have in national parks is very much fence the wildlife in and fence the people out as a whole. If you do that, you're creating a competition between wildlife and people. And if you create that competition, there's only ever going to be one winner, and it won't be the wildlife. So that's not to say there's not a place for that model in national parks, and of course there is. but we have to find other models that allows us not to just operate in that way.
Can you visualize those models? And that's something I have a really hard time with. Like, first of all, is there land that's not already being used that you all can expand wildlife into? And second of all, how do you open those properties up so that there isn't all the fencing?
Yeah, so I think the key thing, so while we talk about fencing, I suppose the key thing is it's not about taking the fencing down altogether. Okay. And not having fencing, because, you know, you've got lions and you've got elephants and rhinos. So, you know, we have to be realistic. We can't have completely fenceless areas and let everything roam through the local villages, because it wouldn't work anywhere in the world. So it's not a case of saying take the fences down. We have to try and link up the different pockets of lands that is fenced in. So we create corridors between the two. Right. So we're gradually opening up perhaps natural migratory routes that were there years ago. Mm-hmm. But so it's more around, and again, I use old Pejeto as a great example of how you can make this work. So, you know, they were having problems on their conservancy of illegal herding. In other words, local people herding their cows onto the wildlife conservancy. The cat, you know, then there's no sort of environmental thoughts of that. They're just grazing the land down, and that's having a massive then impact on wildlife. So, you know, what's the approach that you can do with that? So you can either, you know, go to war with the local people and create this whole sort of completely, you know, impenetrable fence around it, or you try and understand why they're doing what they're doing and how you work with them. So what Dunnell or Pejeto is actually said, well, you can't bring your cattle here, but what we'll do is we'll create a livestock business that operates on the conservancy. So we will employ you to come and herd our cattle rather than you herd your own cattle. So now they have a fixed job with an income coming in, doing what they always did before, which is herding cattle. And we have 6,000 head of cattle on the Alpejeta Conservancy, living alongside lions. You know, the conservancy has the highest density of predators in East Africa on that basis. So in the Laikipia region of Kenya. So that forms this now incredible model where you're not having people coming in using the land illegally. We've actually created employment opportunities for them, and they're still herding their cattle. What that's done is created a much healthier stock of cattle, so that, you know, when those cattle, you know, and a beef business comes out of that, so we created a beef business and abattoirs and butcheries and such like. So you create all these little knock-up additional businesses that come up that create additional employment for local people. That beef has now become the most sought after beef in Kenya. So now that's going at premium. So that creates additional volume coming in. And then what else you see is other knock-on effects. So, you know, when illegal herding, they would put their cattle into a boma at night in what we call acacia bomas, which is kind of, for people that don't know, acacia is quite spiky trees out in Africa. It's the classic sort of African tree you see with the flat top. So they would take the acacia bomas, create theirs, and then, you know, lions would walk past, the cattle would panic, the lions would go in and take them out. So what we started to do there was create metal structure bomas in great big circles, and we will put the cattle in there, and the lions will just walk past. They know they can't get in. The cattle are calm because they know the lions can't get in. And then it's had a huge ecological benefits as well, which wasn't even seen to begin with. So the cattle's obviously, you know, will poo all night and create a layer of dung. And these bomas are designed so when the dung gets to a certain level, we kind of pick these huge bomas up, move it somewhere else. So that dung is killed off the grass, and then it grows back as incredibly nutrient rich because of the dung that was laid on it, as if you put manure on your garden, for example. And what that's done is created, you know, we no longer have to have fire burns, for example, to control, because we can use that. So we, you know, there's a whole ecology department that's saying we need to graze here, we need to graze there, we need to put the cattle overnight here. So that creates that. Now, what Alpejeta does is have corridors, what we call corridors, which is gaps in the fence that allows pretty much all wildlife apart from the rhinos to come in and out through the conservancy at certain points. So what we see is we've got a huge density of herbivores because they're coming in for this nutrient-rich grass that's there. And because you get a high density of herbivores and prey species, now you're getting a high density of predators coming in as well, because there's, you know, when lions have cubs, the density of the prey is so high that cubs are surviving, whereas perhaps they weren't before. So by just having this one sort of, okay, how can we work with the local people? It's created this whole huge bonus from an ecological perspective as well. So that's kind of what I mean around working with the local people. Yes, we still have the fences up, but you've created a model where the local people, you're improving the livelihoods for the local people through the wildlife being there, you know, and it creates other opportunities. We've seen guys who came in, you know, local people who came in to as cattle herders are now on our rhino monitoring team, and you know, the job is walking up and monitoring rhinos, which is a higher paid job than the cattle herders. So it gives employment and, you know, growth opportunities as well. So I think that's the best example as to how you have that opportunity to use land for the benefit of both wildlife and people at the same time. And to answer your question about is the land there, yes, there is quite a lot of degraded land that's available there. There's lots of discussions and negotiations to have with the local people, you know, around wanting to use the land for this purpose and helping them understand how that can help benefit them in the long run as well. So there is definitely lots of opportunities there. It's a time-consuming process to go through both the negotiations, but also the restoring of the land as well. But we will get there because we have to get there.
Yeah, I mean, the creativity you guys are using is just phenomenal.
I think, we have to think out of the box.
You really do.
Long before helping rhinos, you know, the guys we're working with on the ground have been doing this for coming up with these ideas for a long time. And again, that's the importance of everybody working together.
Right.
We all have a role to play. You know, as I said, our role as an NGO is not necessarily to get down on the ground and start negotiating with the local people. It really mm-hmm. needs to be local people doing that. You know, mm-hmm. our role is to work with them and supply the funding that is needed to enable the restoration, because, you know, it's not a cheap business to restore land and to pick up corridors and link all these different places together. You know, there is farmland that's in between there, so some of that has to be bought. We're talking about, you know, millions of, if not tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to bring this to fruition over a number of years to come. So if anyone watching happens to have a few hundred million dollars, but if not, we'll, you know, we start like anything, you start small on the pockets and you start to build in like a jigsaw piece.
Yeah. Well, it's incredible. And so, like, how do you find the people that you're working with on the ground? Do they come to you? Do they find you? Is it a combination of you finding them, they finding you?
Yeah, it's a bit of a combination. Unfortunately, the conservation world is a very small world, and you know, you tend to find you meet somebody new and you find that actually you've got many shared acquaintances. Yeah. And you know, that's quite nice when you're working in that world, but it's one of the biggest problems we have because you know, it is such a small world. So I think when you start to get in there, it was about who you know, building networks, you know, talking to people, going out meeting people. And understanding, you know, we have a vision of where we think it's important to focus on. And then it's, you know, we know some people who work in there, and then that'll create other conversations. So it is a little bit of just building, you know, like with any business, I suppose, it's building a network. And yes, we're a charity and we're raising funds, but, you know, we do try and operate as any other business would do. And I always joke that We do operate as a business. That's our goal. Our goal is to raise maximum profits we can. It's just that our shareholders are munching grass on the plains of Africa and not sitting in a boardroom. But that's the model that we approach. And if we can operate that way, we'll be sustainable. We'll be bringing in the maximum values that we can, and the rhinos will benefit to a maximum on the bat.
Yeah, and not just that's the thing, though. It's not just the rhinos that are benefiting. It's everything that's benefiting from keeping the rhinos.
Exactly. We're called helping rhinos, and you know, and so we focus on areas where there are rhinos, and that's kind of the flagship species for us. But you're absolutely right. You know, if we make an area safe for rhinos, we're making it safe for everything. If the rhino's under the biggest threat from poaching and we can stop that, then we're making it safe from poaching for all the other species. If we're creating a new environment that's great for black rhinos, well, guess what? It's not only great for black rhinos. There's a whole host of species that we're creating. You know, and we see that in rewilding projects around the world. You see that, you know, you let the land come back, and actually things just, you know, it's amazing how quickly land and fauna and flora can recover if we let it.
Yeah, I think we've seen that during COVID.
Yeah, there's definitely been good examples of that during COVID.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there was I watched recently the new David Attenborough film. I'm not sure it's out in the US yet, but certainly it's on Netflix here in the UK. This is one called A Life on Our Planet, or My Life on Our Planet. And without spoiling it too much, you know, I'm sure people have heard of the Chernobyl disaster, you know, with the nuclear explosion and this whole town evacuated overnight, you know, and actually they show it now and, you know, it's essentially a forest. You know, and it shows how the planet can recover and will recover even in the most extreme circumstances if we let it. The point is we've got to let it.
Yeah. Well, I want to help get some funds to you. So where can people, what's the best way for people to connect with you and the work that you're doing?
So, thank you, Jenny. The best way is to go to our website. So helpingrhinos.org. And on there you'll find sections which is called Our Work, so you'll see in more detail about the projects. And you know, we've not even had a chance to talk about the orphanage, so I would encourage you to go and look at the orphanage pages as well, because you know, saving the little rhinos is always cute. There's lots of good videos on there, so have a look at our pages there. I would say there's two key things at the moment I would perhaps encourage people to do. One is two of our rhino orphans, one of which came in at 2 days old, on pipes and tubes, and it was awful. And she's now four and is about to be released back into the wild, which is the aim for all of our orphans. So we currently have a campaign running to try and raise the funds to send Makosi, which is our rhino, and Mpilo back to the wild. And also, if I could also encourage people to go to our events page, we are having undoubtedly the biggest online event we've ever had. It was supposed to be a big gala dinner in London with our partner in Kenya, Olpejitu, who I've mentioned a few times.
Yes.
And raising funds for them. And I should just say that, you know, Olpejitu, the reason we work so closely with Olpejitu is they have the largest population of black rhino in East and Central Africa.
Wow.
So, a huge conservation success story. And perhaps the other side of that, but better known, is they're also home to the last two northern white rhinos in the world, Najin and Fatu, and was home to Sudan, the last male before he died of natural causes in 2018. I think Sudan's probably the most famous rhino in the world, or was the most famous rhino in the world. But so as part of our, we were supposed to be having a big gala dinner in London, but COVID has put a stop to that, unfortunately. So not to be defeated, we have gone online. And actually the benefits perhaps to some people is that, you know, because it's online now, it's now a global event, and it's
right.
It's not just a London-based event. So Saturday, the 21st of November at 6 p.m. UK time, which I think is 10 o'clock in the morning Pacific time and 1 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. So we've done it on a Saturday, so that hopefully it works for people all around the world. And we will be streaming onto it's a private YouTube channel. So you do need to register at our website, but it's free to register. And we are streaming live from a specially designed studio in London. And even more exciting, we're streaming live from a waterhole on Olpejitu in Kenya.
That's so great.
We have James Mwenda with us in Kenya, who is, if people have been following rhinos will know, he's one of the caretakers of the last two northern white rhinos. We have the TV presenter Giles Clark with us in London. We have an auction. We have got some amazing auction items, original artwork, and all sorts of things going on. So we've got features on the Black Rhino. We have virtual game drives ending with sundowners, which people don't know what sundowners are. It's when you're on a game drive in Africa and as the sun's going down, you stop and have a glass of wine or a gin and tonic or a beer. And so we're encouraging everybody to have sundowners with us. Or maybe if you're on the east, west coast of America and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, maybe it's more sun uppers than downers. But come and join us, have some fun. We've got some educational stuff. We have an interview with the leader of the scientific team working to on an IVF program to give the northern white rhinos a future. So we have an exclusive interview with him on the night, and we have our auction. So we are incredibly excited about it. I'll be honest, we're a little bit nervous as well, because it's by far the biggest thing we've done, and there's all this technology, but it's going to be great. So please do come along and get involved, because
that sounds great.
If we don't get people watching and joining us, then you know, it'll all be for nothing. So hopefully people will join and come along and have fun with us.
Yeah, well, I'll alert everybody on my email.
Thank you.
And everybody I can find, I'll tell them about it.
Yeah, I'll send you some stuff through Jenny as well that you can forward out on email.
Yes, I would love that. I would totally love that. So I wanted to tell you also, because I don't want to keep you too long, and I don't want this to shut off on us, but I talked to Ari van Dierventer from the Rhino Orphanage.
Okay.
I don't know if you are working with him at all, but...
Not directly. So there's a few orphanages. There's the Rhino Orphanage, there's Care for Wild, and the orphanage, our orphanage is Zululand Rhino Orphanage.
Okay.
And they're in different locations. Yeah. And obviously as they need to be, because the rhinos are being poached in different
everywhere.
Areas.
Yeah.
So I do know Ari. I know of him directly, but obviously we don't work with him directly.
Yeah.
But I'm pleased to say that, you know, after a slow start a few years ago, the orphanages now do all kind of talk to each other, share best practices on the whole.
Yeah,
so, you know,
again,
it's all about working together for what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. And I know that Tula Lawrence Anthony, who did the Elephant Whisperer, they started a rhino orphanage as well.
So Tula was out. That was our orphanage. So when we started work, we were Tula Rhino Orphanage was there. So that's where McCorsey came into the rhino I mentioned, who's being released back into. But you might, if you know of them, you may be aware that they were victims to poachers themselves. And so poachers attacked the orphanage one night, killed two of the rhino, beat up the staff. It was awful. And actually, we made the decision at that point to close that facility as a rhino, as a dedicated rhino orphanage, and moved to a different new secret location, which is what has become the Zululand Rhino Orphanage.
I didn't know that.
So definitely, I was visiting Tula before they even had the first animals in. So it was great. It was fantastic. Such a shame that what happened. But we had to take the learnings from it. And as I said, so the rhinos who were there, the likes of McCorsey and Nandi and Storm, the black rhino. So Storm's now back in the wild already. Charlie, the hippo who was there, is quite famous around the world. So they're all at Zululand Rhino Orphanage now.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, I get their newsletter, and it's hard to keep track of everything, but...
There's a lot going on. But as I say, it is a small world as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you all are working together. Everybody's learning from everybody. But I just think the work that Helping Rhinos is doing is phenomenal. And this will go off. I'll put on your website at the back of the video as well. And we'll get some people attending the November 21st event.
Perfect. Brilliant. Thank you, Jenny.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk to everyone that's watching your channel.
Well, I'm so excited that you agreed to come on, and I hope to talk to you again at another point. We'll catch up again. Is there anything you feel really driven to say before we go that I missed?
I covered it. I don't know how long I've been talking for. My team will tell you once I start, it's difficult to stop me. But
that's what we need. We need to learn from people like you who can educate us on what's going on.
Sorry. No, I think we've covered things. I think the thing I would say is, you know, as a closing remark would be, you know, everybody has a role to play. You know, we can't all give up our, you know, lives and change direction and perhaps do what I did, but everybody has a role to play, whether that's, you know, following on social media, sharing our posts on social media, spreading the word, you know, doing an adoption, taking out an adoption for one of our rhinos, you know, sponsoring one of the black mambas, attending our events. We all have different roles to play. Our lives are all different. So, you know, what works for one person doesn't work for another. But essentially that's my message, is that, you know, please don't do nothing and think someone else will do it.
Yes.
Do something, and every little helps. And as I said, you know, the sum of the parts is much greater than many different individuals. So yeah, follow us at helpingrhinos.org, follow us on social media, and hopefully we'll see you at an event.
Yes. Simon, thank you so much.
Cool. Thanks, Jenny.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington, production by Stacy Spencer of Going Graphic, sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media, and music written and performed by Jake Shepard.